The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for September 23rd, 2017. To all who celebrate, Happy New Year, Lashana Tova for the Jewish year 5777. It is my hope that you have a healthy, happy, and sweet year. As you probably know, this show is pre-recorded, as I'm actually in Boston with Brian at the New England Builders Ball. I will be reporting on what and who when I return to the studio next week. Meanwhile, I have both a new and encore show for you. Since it is interbike time out in Las Vegas, I was able to snag Steve Frothingham, who is the online editor of Bicycle Retailer and Industry News. We will get the skinny on what's going on at the show, what's hot, what's not, what people are saying about this final edition of the Las Vegas show as it moves to Reno in 2018. Then, after a short break, I'm going to be offering up my 2012 conversation with one of my favorite people, Don Ferris. Don is the proprietor of Anvil Bike Works in Colorado, and he's hilarious, hardworking, smart as hell, and basically an all-around good guy. This interview will highlight all of his characteristics and then some. If you've heard it before, it's still relevant and fun, and if not, you might just want to replay it a second time. Then, in honor of the Builders Ball and their commitment to that event, I'm offering up my conversation with gold sponsor Copenhagen Wheel. This interview took place in 2014. So off to Las Vegas to speak with Steve Frothingham about Interbike 2017. Hi, Steve. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. How's Las Vegas?
It is warm and dry, as always.
Yeah.
Not quite so hot this year as other years.
Really? I think we got it. You know, we didn't have a summer, and now all of a sudden it's summer in Cleveland, so go figure. But we are having great baseball, so I really can't complain. So how is Interbike?
My take this year is it is a more compact show. There are clearly fewer exhibitors here. And a lot of the exhibitors I have smaller booths than they've had in the past. And that actually makes it look a little more crowded than it would. I don't think the dealer count is way, way down. So when you're in the halls, there's a lot of people walking around. The booths are crowded. And, you know, my take is that people here this year are here for a reason. They're not just here because they feel like they have to come. They came here for something very specific. If they're retailers, they came to get educated and see new product. If they're exhibitors, they came here because they have something good to show, and that's good. So sometimes, you know, in the past there have been some really massive booths that have a lot of glitz and bells and whistles but don't really have a lot of content. So there's not a lot of that this year.
What do you hear about? What do you feel? Let's use that as the mood of the show. I mean, obviously, we know this is the last year in Vegas, and I don't think there's going to be a lot of horrible sentiment about that. But what about the mood of the show, both from an exhibitor and an attendee perspective?
Well, like I said, I think that there is focus, and I think the people that came are the people that are having good years. So there are a lot of bright spots in the industry. There's categories and areas where there's a lot of energy. There's people that are growing. And even at the outdoor demo, it was very small, but the people who were there were getting a lot of attention from the retailers, and all the bikes that were available were getting tested and ridden. And so there was actually, I think, a lot of pretty good energy. I think that, you know, the people that didn't have a really good year stayed home.
Well, so, and I think that's usually the case. You know, if you can't afford to get on an airplane or drive out to Las Vegas and rent a hotel and eat and do all that, then you need to stay home. I totally get that. So who do you think are some of the success stories as far as exhibitors go this year? I imagine you're seeing a lot of e-bikes.
There's a lot of e-bike action. I really feel like this is the year that the bulk of retailers started to take e-bikes very seriously. They came here to test the bikes and, you know, attend the seminars to learn about how to sell them and how to service them. And, you know, I think that clearly there have been some reluctance for a few years for a lot of people to adopt e-bikes seriously. But I think after a tough couple years in the industry, I think a lot of people are very serious about learning about them and seriously thinking about what brands they might carry and what they need to do to bring them into their shops. And then, you know, it's a question. I think this is the e-bike thing is something that's almost being driven from the top down, you know, from the suppliers down to the retailers, down to the bike riders out there. And there's been early adopters and there's been people who have been on the fence. And I think that, you know, the next front is almost moving down to if the stores stock the bikes, are people going to buy them?
What about the pushback, or is there any pushback? Are you hearing anything about legislation? You know, e-bikes are not necessarily welcome on roads, and yet they're not welcome on trails, and they certainly are not welcome on sidewalks. Are you hearing anything about that?
I'm hearing a little bit about that. There's still some confusion, and I think the industry is doing a good job of trying to work in state houses around the country to try to push for relatively standard laws across the states, because it usually is a state issue, and it could be really frustrating if one state has very different laws than another state. And so the industry is doing a great job of trying to work in, you know, 50 different state houses around the country. And I've covered state legislatures in the past, and I think that's where the term herding cats came from. So it's a tough job, but
especially in this political climate.
Yeah, but it's happening, you know, and some of the biggest states have already, you know, California, Colorado, New York, some of the biggest population states in the country have adopted very similar legislation. And so I think it's all moving in the right direction there.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Steve Frothingham. He is the online editor for Bicycle Retailer and Industry News, which is our trade journal in our business. So was there any kind of a product or, I guess just basically product that just blew you away so far? Is there anything that you just saw that you said, this is cool?
Me personally, I've been on deadline all week, so I haven't had time to really get out there and, you know, indulge my bike lust yet. I'm looking forward to getting out there today and checking out some eye candy. But what I've heard is a few different things. The Turn GSD bike, which is it's an electric folding cargo bike, got a lot of attention. It won the media award the other night at the media preview. It's just a very practical cargo bike. It can carry a couple passengers. It can carry, I don't know how many hundreds of pounds of cargo, and yet it's still fairly compact. You can fit it in the back of a van. or a SUV. You can store it up on end, standing up in your apartment.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Or at your office. So it really got a lot of attention. There's a lot of electric cargo bikes out there now, but the Tern seems to be a really nice, refined product. Other than that, you know, a few things that got a lot of attention. I think the Pinion gearbox for the mountain bike crowd. That's a kind of a transmission that is mounted inside a box on the frame. Requires almost no maintenance. It's just very solid. You can shift while you're pedaling or while you're posting or while you're stopped. And it's been available in Europe for years, but they're really just opened up a U.S. sales office just this month in Denver. And there were a lot of people very interested in that out at the demo the other day.
I saw that the Triathlon Pavilion, I did read the daily from yesterday anyway, but mm-hmm. I saw that the Triathlon Pavilion looks like it had really good attendance. I imagine Dan Emfield was up there yapping about triathlons.
He's always there. Yeah, he's Mr. Triathlon. Yeah, I think the triathlon is a bright spot. There's a lot of little bright spots in the industry. You know, I think the whole power meter part of the world and the indoor smart trainers, there's a lot of energy there. There's a lot of people, frankly, a lot of people making money there. BMX, you know, has always been up and down.
Yep.
And it appears to be on the up this year and last year or so.
I would say that the cycle is just about right.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of good stuff going on with youth cycling, NICA. You know, even little things like, you know, daytime riding lights are a big category right now. There's a lot of people that are buying lights to use on their bikes during the day. That didn't exist 2 or 3 years ago, but it's kind of all the rage right now. And of course, you know, off-road touring / gravel riding / mountain bike touring, whatever you want, adventure riding, whatever you want to call it. There's a lot of interest in that right now. A lot of very interesting accessories and parts and tires and frames and bikes coming out in that world.
So before I let you go, and I know you have an appointment, I want to ask you one thing about 2018. So the show is moving to Reno. It was in Reno many, many years ago for a couple of years, and I do remember
that.
No, it is not. But what are you hearing? Are people saying it's a good thing? It's a bad thing? I'm glad to see it happening. I'm not glad. I mean, we were kind of hoping it would come a little more east, but I understand that.
As a East Coast native myself, I do feel like Reno is a long way away for anybody east of the Rockies. But still, there's a lot of direct flights. It's not really that hard to get to. But I think there's a lot of interest. I think there's a lot of curiosity. There's a lot of people that think that, you know, just the novelty factor alone will help bring some people back, both on the retail side and on the exhibitor side. People that got bored with Las Vegas or turned off by Las Vegas after being here for 18 or 20 years. Might come back. Costs should be lower. I'm not sure. I don't have any numbers on how much cheaper it's going to be to be there, but it is going to be a little bit cheaper.
For the exhibitors, you mean? For the exhibitors?
Mostly for the exhibitors.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing.
But if it's cheaper for the exhibitors, that means more of them will show up. It will make it more valuable for the retailers to come too. And a lot of people are very excited about the riding. It's much better there, both on the road and off-road. You can't underplay that. That's a big deal.
Well, the last big elephant in the room question is, how relevant is this trade show?
I think it's very relevant. I think the organizers are very aware of that question. And I think they're, you know, almost obsessed with thinking about, you know, what they can do to be relevant. And so they line up speakers and hold sessions and seminars and events that try to face those topics head on. You know, like I said, I think it still serves its purpose. It maybe it's clearly a different show than it was 20 years ago. You don't have those big anchor exhibitors, those giant.
No pun intended, right? No
pun intended. Giant's not here. But yeah, we don't have the big specialized Trek, Schwinn, those giant bike companies that used to sort of be the anchors of the show. They're not here. And I don't know that that's really going to change anytime soon. But like I said, when we first started talking, I think the people that are here are very focused about why they're here and what they need to get done. And so that that makes it relevant.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time. I know you're busy today. It's your first day on the show floor. And go have some fun. I hope you brought another pair of shoes.
I have several pairs of shoes.
Yes. Well, thanks for much, so much for talking with me. Steve Frothingham, right. Bicycle retailer. We'll talk to you again.
Thanks, Dan.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye. Steve Frothingham joined me from probably on his way to the exhibit hall in Las Vegas talking about Interbike 2017. So we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll begin the encore portion of the show. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We're back, and we're reaching into the archives of the Outspoken Cyclist as we bring up an interview from 2012 with Anvil Bike Works' Don Ferris. Don, thanks for joining us on the show this evening.
Well, thank you, Diane. Glad to be here.
So we're going to talk about you, and we're going to talk about Anvil Bike Works. And the first thing I want to know is, you say professional tools for the professional builder. I want to know how you define a professional builder.
Well, I think a professional builder is anybody who builds frames for money from others. You know, not your kids, not your family, but from others. If you're taking orders and you're taking money, and then you're a professional builder, as far as I'm concerned.
So you don't necessarily subscribe to Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000. You got to do something 10,000 times to get it right.
Well, I'm a redneck. I don't know who Malcolm Gladwell is, but
Mr. Outlier. He wrote a book called Outliers.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No. I know about that book.
Yeah. So you're not
the
such a redneck.
The whole thing about Bill Gates' mom having running the computer and all that. Yeah.
Well, and that's the being in the right place at the right time is sort of what that's all about. But
But
I just wondered if maybe being a professional also had to do with actually building a specific number of frames, or more than two or three that you're building, whatever.
Well, I think there's probably 50 shades of professional, if you want to do it that way. It's, custom frame builders, most of them don't sell lots of bikes. If a custom builder, a professional, full-time custom builder is doing 50 bikes a year, depending on the level of service and what he's offering, then that's probably a lot. So doing something 10,000 times, building 10,000 frames or filing 10,000 dropouts or whatever is going to take, might be a career.
Might be a couple of lifetimes, actually.
Yeah. It could take quite a
That's
while.
True.
I mean, there's a lot of frame builders out there who are much more prolific, but I think, you get, here's the way I like to put it. You get a guy who's been doing it for 35 years, and he's got the same 1 year of experience 35 times over. And then you got a guy who's been doing it for a few years, but he has, a talent for it. And his 50th frame may be better than somebody else's 500th frame. I think it's all about the individual. Not to take words from Lance Armstrong, but maybe it's not really about the bike. I mean, it's building bike frames is, it's part science, part craft, part art. Some guys have the full package, some guys don't.
I like that explanation. I think I like that a lot. So you also make a distinction between a fixture and a jig.
Yeah, I do.
Wait, you don't seem happy.
Well, you can blame that on my dad. My dad always said that jigs were made by carpenters.
Okay.
That's not to disparage any carpenters who might be listening. But my dad was a lifelong machinist, and I learned a lot of what I know from him. And he was just very pointed on the fact that a machinist used a fixture and a carpenter used a jig. And it's really semantics, and I understand that, but we call them fixtures anyway.
And that's, you can put the word professional in front of that, and it looks a little different from the
wooden jig that some people make at home.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not where I was going with that.
Okay.
But no, I get your point. Yeah. No, okay. I mean, it's, you know, a fixer is used to locate things very precisely. And when I said it's semantics between fixtures and jigs, because the definitions of what those two things are cross quite often. And, but yeah, we call them fixtures.
Okay.
And we call them fixtures because that's what my dad told me to call them.
Okay. It's not a bad reason. It's not
yeah.
a bad reason.
Yeah,
so
no.
Let's go back to frame building itself for a second. In an interview you gave for Mountain Flyer magazine, you stated that you had the perfect skill set for frame building, only to find out that it was incredibly more difficult. What was so daunting about it?
Well, it is. A lot of people think, you know, it's sticking, you know, X number of tubes together. And it's not. It, you know, basically a bicycle frame is a stress-skin structure, and you're working I should start over. Here's the deal. The deal is that people have, and frame builders are largely responsible for this, but people have an unrealistic expectation of how precise a frame should be built. And I think that when you first get into building frames, that you really want to try to meet all those numbers and those little goalposts that other people have set or claim to have set. And so you'll often see, you know, you'll often see references to, you know, perfectly aligned frames, you know, zero tolerance, you know, with a line to X amount of thousands of inches. And that's fine, but it's mostly BS.
Okay.
And so what happens is, like I was saying, is that you have this unrealistic expectation of how precisely a frame could be or should be built. And being a machinist, I understand that that's, like I said, mostly BS. It's just not that achievable. And if you do achieve it, it won't stay that way for long. And so when you first start out building, you have this idea that it's going to be a very simple matter of putting some tubes together. You're kind of going to hold them in these places, and when you're done, it's going to be, you know, a perfect bicycle frame. And that's not the case at all. And what happens is that once you start sticking these tubes together, what seems to be a very simple process becomes very complex because you're actually working in, you know, a 4D environment. You know, a 3D environment, you know, X, Y, and Z, plus you have a fourth dimension of time. And so the less time you have to get it together, the harder and harder and harder it is. And so what you'll see is when people build their first few frames, even if they've had professional instruction, it takes them forever, you know, on the relative time scale. And then when you have done it, maybe back to your 10,000th time, you know, in Outliers, you know, there are frame builders who can go out there to the shop, custom builders, with a drawing in hand, and I'm probably letting all these secrets out, but they go out to the shop and the drawing in hand and, you know, and a tube set on the bench, and an hour later they have a frame that's assembled.
Interesting. Very
so,
interesting.
But, you know, a new guy coming into it might take him a month. And it is, when you first do it, very complex, and I think it's a little intimidating because you have to have all these tubes have to have the same the correct spatial relationships. And that's just the part about getting the tubes together. Then you have to consider about, you know, all the constraints or requirements that the components you're going to use place on you. Tire clearance, you know, derailleur placement, chainring clearance, fork crown clearance, you know, where brazons go on if you're doing racks like for a random A-bike. I mean, it just gets more and more and more complex. And by and large, frame builders are grossly underpaid.
Well, that I can attest to, A.
Yeah.
And B, I think that those are some very interesting points that have not been brought up in other interviews we've done about the placement of the components, because I think that today's production manufacturer is forgetting about a lot of those things, too, you know, and not allowing for more clearance for brakes or better tolerance for chainring differences from 53 to 50 or whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, a road bike construction is fairly straightforward, you know, for your classic road racing bike.
Right.
You know, you want difficult, build a 29-inch mountain bike with suspension.
Yeah.
I mean,
no, I don't want difficult,
you know,
but
you're
okay.
You're trying to cram all this stuff in the, you know, the same space that's occupied by other stuff. Building a road bike, a road racing road bike, is, you know, extremely straightforward, comparatively speaking. But that doesn't mean that it's easy.
Right.
And because bicycles are simple, people expect them to be easy. But simple and easy aren't the same thing.
So at one point, you were building some frames. You went to Interbike to show off your frames, and everybody was interested in the tools. And I had to laugh because I certainly get how that could happen. So how do you feel about the resurgence of all these handmade frames, the NABS, you know, sort of phenomenon that Don Walker started, what, 9, 10 years ago? And, you know, did you finally abandon building frames altogether?
Man, you're combining a lot into one
Okay, cut it up any way you see fit, but give me 1 second to let me remind our listeners we're talking with Don Ferris in Golden, Colorado, and Don is the proprietor of Anvil Bike Works. Okay, go.
Okay, yeah. What was the question again?
No, oh, I don't know.
Yeah, it's true. It wasn't actually Interbike, I don't think, that I took the – it was a different show.
Okay.
But I used to go to Interbike, but I took my frames. I was very proud. I had my tools that I had made as a backdrop, and then I had my frames mounted in frame fixtures, and I had various components mounted in various other fixtures that I had made, and at that show, they might as well have been my frames might as well have been made out of glass. You know, everybody was coming up and saying, "Hey, man, where'd you get those tools?" And I was kind of blown away by that. And actually, I had a friend of mine, Todd Schusterman, who owns Da Vinci Designs, and
yep.
he was kind of prescient with that because he said, you know, when he saw my stuff and he helped me a lot when I very first got started, he was saying, you know, what you ought to do is build tools. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'll never sell one of these things.
Yeah, right.
And I ended up selling all my stuff at that show.
Right, exactly, and had to go home and make more.
Yeah, and it just kind of went on from there. It was looking back on it now, I was just very, very lucky. I mean, there's really no other way to describe it. I was just very, very lucky. I was in the right place in the right time. I wasn't trying to do it; it just happened, and it kind of fell in my lap. And so it wasn't long after that. I mean, it was just a few years. Well, not a few years. I mean, it was 2004 that finally I had to give up building frames. And that was a very difficult thing to do because the tooling just took over. And I had, by that time, by 2004, I had invested enough into the tools that I needed to make the tools that I just had to make the transition.
Well,
it was a very tough thing to do. It took a long time to come to that conclusion, but I was basically just pissing off all of my customers. I couldn't deliver tools on time. I couldn't deliver frames on time. I just had too much on my plate.
So there are some very nice photographic sets on your Flickr site, which people can find also on your website, which we'll tell them at the end of our conversation, that show these incredibly beautiful tools. Now, I work in a bike shop. I've worked in a bike shop for the last 38 years. I understand tools. I had a Campy toolkit, all that stuff. But this stuff is like jewelry. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How many different fixtures and tools are you offering to builders now?
A lot.
That's a good answer.
Yeah. I'm a frustrated frame builder. No, you know, if you look at the Renaissance, which you were speaking to earlier of frame building, and not only in the United States but all over the world, actually, the quality and the level of frames that's being produced today by the handmade builders is astounding. I mean, it's kind of jaw dropping when you look at some of the work that these guys are doing. It's just amazing. And so, I don't do that. I don't get to do that. You know, I get to make tools. And so tools are my job, and when I started off making tools for others, I just made the decision, and I had the drive to that I wanted to make tools that anybody would be proud to own. You know, they had to work right, they had to look good. You know that, and tools say a lot about the builder. And you know, if you go into your garage to a mechanic for your car, and he's got, you know, cheapy Fred tools laying all over the garage floor and whatever, you know, you immediately make an assumption. You judge that person based on that. And when you go into the mechanic and he's got the, you know, the big Snap-on roll around and blah blah blah, you know, you're thinking, okay, this guy's really got an investment in his craft. And I kind of see it that way myself. And I've had lots and lots of customers who tell me that a lot of times the tooling, when the customers come into their shop and see the tooling, they're like, man, you're the man.
And you know what? That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
You know, there is a lot of the selling that goes on just by looking around. So
completely true, yeah.
All right. I want to know what metrology is. Did I say it right?
Yeah.
Okay. Talk about metrology.
No, metrology is measuring stuff, basically. It is, when it's normally used, you're talking about precision measurements, you know, making very, very accurate, repeatable measurements.
Okay.
And so, and metrology is a big deal in a machine shop, most machine shops, because it's easy to say, well, that thing's good within a thousandth of an inch. And then you look around their shop, and they don't have anything that'll actually measure a thousandth of an inch. You know,
okay.
I mean, it's just one of those deals, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that. I didn't know that. I figured if they're saying so, well, they have to be able to prove it. Guess not, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And if you don't have the tools, then you can't do it. And generally, you know, you chase. What we talk about here in our shop is, you know, we're chasing decimal points, and it's called the ghost in the machine. You know, you're chasing a ghost when it comes to dimensions, because basically you get far enough to the right side of that decimal point, and you come to the crux of what you can actually measure with accuracy and preciseness, which not really the same things, but you know, how fine you can actually measure. So the height gauge that we use, the Tessa height gauge that we use on our surface plate, resolves down to the millionths. So it'll read down to millionths of an inch.
Who can see millionths of
it? Okay. Can. Yeah,
okay.
You can't see it. And
okay.
So, but the machine is telling you, but the machine is lying to you. Because even though the machine will resolve down to millionths, it can't accurately and repeatably measure down to the millionths. It has to be able to resolve down to the millionths to be able to accurately and repeatedly measure a 10,000th of an inch.
Uh-huh.
And so we measure, you know, to the fourth decimal place over there, four digits over from the decimal place, 1/10,000th of an inch. And that's what we measure for. And we do that knowing that if we can measure to the tenth, we can claim to the thousandth.
Okay.
You see what I mean?
Yeah. No, I totally
so
see what you mean.
If you go 10 times beyond what you're trying to get,
right,
you don't really know if that thousandth is there or not.
Is accurate. Sure.
It kind of goes back to my talking earlier about alignment on bicycle frames, where you know, Joe Bob Builder will say, you know, my frames are perfectly aligned, you know, giving you an impression that it's, if you were to measure the theoretical center line and all the critical points on that frame, it would be zero from one end to the other. And, you know, you're talking a frame is 36, 40 inches, some odd long across the diagonal, you know, even on a road bike.
Right.
And it's basically a stress skin structure, so it's a series of very, very thin tubes joined together. And it ain't happening. You just can't do it. I mean, and if you do, it's luck. And it won't stay there anyways. You know, if you have a window open and the sun shines in on one side of the frame is going to twist, you know, to that direction. And so it's just what is what's achievable for alignment on a frame. And I think a lot of people think custom frames and they think perfectly aligned. And that's not really the case. When they think custom frames, they should think, you know, handmade, handcrafted, relationship with a builder, you know, great care taken, you know, to make a unique product for a customer. But But I see it all the time. I see guys claiming they can do this or that with their frames, and the reality is, you know, if they can hold a half a millimeter, they're really good.
Wow, I really appreciate that explanation. It was dead on,
Thank you.
It makes so much sense to me. So I'm just going to move on a little bit. How has NABS changed your business? Has it? Or is that just one more thing on the pile?
Yeah. Well, I think NABS has changed the business for the custom builder more than it has the custom builder supplier.
Okay.
I think as a service to the custom builder, the bespoke builder, you know, anybody who takes an order before they make the frame, I think it's done them great service. It's probably the single greatest thing that's ever happened to them, to bring them out into the limelight and place them on a more equal footing with, you know, the brand names that have, you know, television ads and full-page spreads and periodicals and whatnot. It's phenomenal. Don Walker, you know, should have a bust of him casting golds in somewhere. You know, there's a lot of people involved with the development of NABS, but Don was the guy that made it happen. And
right.
So, you know, no matter what else Don does for the rest of his life, he's going to have that little box is going to be checked for him. And
that's good.
And he's done great things for people.
So you mentioned Jill, and I saw the word Antarctica somewhere.
Yeah.
What's the relationship there? What's the connection?
With Jill and Antarctica, or with Antarctica, Jill and I?
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
Well, I met Jill in Antarctica, of all places.
Yeah, that's what I thought I read.
Yeah, I know, it's crazy, right? I had to go to the very ends of the earth to find somebody who would marry me. Yeah, I know, it's crazy.
All right, what were you doing there? What was she doing there? And okay, just tell me the short version.
Well, before I became Anvil Bike Works tool builder to the stars, I worked in the United States Antarctic Program.
Nice.
And yeah, and so I went down there. My first year on the ice was 1990, and I worked there until I started Anvil, which was in about 1998. And Jill also worked down there, and we met my first year down there, and we hated each other.
Of course.
I was in charge of a project out on an island, Black Island, and we were actually at that time building the communication center for McMurdo Station. And Jill was in charge of the Berg Field Center, the BFC, as it was called, is called. And I needed things from her, and she needed things from me, and we never wanted to give them to each other. And then and that was the first time we met. And then after that it was. I don't really know how to describe it, how it really happened, but we became fast friends, and then we became more than that, and then we got married in 1997, and it's been wedded bliss ever since.
I got it. That's great.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, who would have thought you literally go to the ends of the earth and meet the person you're going to marry?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it is crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So the last thing I really want to talk about has nothing to do with bikes or frame building or fixturing or tools. It has to do with music.
Uh-huh.
Because there was a comment at the end of that Mountain Flyer interview to talk about your music. So what's so special about Don Ferris's music choices?
I don't think there's anything really special. I'm kind of you know, when I'm old.
Oh, yeah, right.
Well, I'm 50.
Both the people in this room are going.
But my music tastes have never matured. I still listen to all the same music my kids listen to. Actually, I turn them on all the good stuff. They usually don't get the good stuff. But no, you know, we listen to music in the shop every day, and I mean every day. It's blaring. But you can't listen to the radio. You know, you have to listen to music from, because you just don't want to hear the same commercials, you know, for an 8, 10, 12-hour shift. And so, you know, I make up playlists and stuff, and I have a huge selection of music to choose from, and everybody who comes over loves our stuff. I don't know.
So what did you turn your kids on to? Like who?
Now you're going to put me on the spot.
Yeah, I am.
I hope my kids aren't listening because they're going to call me a liar. But some of them I probably shouldn't even say that I turned my kids on to because some people would think it's inappropriate. But
I won't. I probably did the same thing.
They're 26 and 21 now, so I think the statute of limitations has gone by.
Yeah.
But, no, I mean, all kinds of stuff. Left Lane Cruiser, Power Solo, you know, just there's just a ton of and not to be a hipster about it, but there's just a ton of music out there that's played by people, you know, that never get on the radio. They're like the custom builders of the music world, and they all have their fans and cults and whatnot. And but yeah, we play a lot of rockabilly. We play a lot of old country in the shop. You know, George Jones, Johnny Cash. You know, any of that kind of stuff. It's if it's authentic, I guess is one way to put it.
All right.
But yeah, no, we listen to all kinds of crazy stuff. Stuff we probably shouldn't be listening to. We listen to rap. We listen to punk. We, you know, and it's just a constant. It's just a constant stream. But we only play with my iPod, and that's one of the privileges of being a boss.
Yeah, it's only what's on my iPod, not on yours.
Yeah, I don't want to fall asleep when I'm in front of the mill.
No, so, good idea. Yeah. I like that.
Oh, no, not your iPod, but I'm talking about one of my guys.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what? This was so much fun, and Brian told me this was going to be fun. He has a lot of respect for you and what you do, and so do I. So thanks for talking to me. We will see each other at NABS in Denver in 2013,
yep.
And I hope you have a great rest of the summer.
I hope I do, too.
Thank you.
And I hope you do, and thanks a lot for having me on, Diane. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Have a good night.
You, too.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed the encore presentation of my interview with Don Ferris from 2012. We're going to take another real short break, and then we'll be back so you can hear the encore presentation of my interview with Eric Barber from Copenhagen Wheel from March of 2014. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Back, and here is my interview from March 2014 with Eric Barber from Copenhagen Wheel. Eric, thank you for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
There's been a lot of press and a lot of interest in the Copenhagen Wheel, and I want to talk with you about it. Tell us a little bit about the project, how it began, why it began, and then we're going to ramp up to what's going to be happening as it gets released this spring.
Sure. So the Copenhagen Wheel started from a partnership between the MIT Sensible City Lab and the city of Copenhagen, which is one of the world's most cycling savvy cities. The main motivation behind the project was looking at how do we get more people to ride bicycles versus car travel and public transport travel. And that's where the name the Copenhagen Wheel came from, was that partnership.
Okay. And when did the project begin?
So the project began about spring semester in 2008. And it was really a clean sheet kind of project as far as, you know, how do we get people riding bicycles? You know, everything, if the solution was to load them up on espresso, then that's what we'd be doing today. But instead, it was looking at different technologies that were out there and looking at e-bikes in particular and taking kind of a different approach to what's traditionally been done so far in the e-bike market.
Which is basically put some batteries somewhere on the bike.
Right. It's more of a, you know, let's modify the bike frame, let's hang batteries someplace, let's get a motor, you know, either at the crank or the rear wheel. And, you know, there's a lot of addition of, you know, wiring and controls and things like that. So we really looked at, you know, how you can preserve, you know, the bicycle that you already have, but now seeing this great capability.
Yeah, and I have some questions about how the wheel's going to mount in a little bit later in our interview from the technical perspective. So in layman's terms, how does the wheel work? What is it that is happening with that beautiful red hub that we see?
The wheel is basically a self-contained unit that can be retrofit onto almost any bike just by replacing the back wheel and then downloading an app on your phone to be able to further enhance the functionality. And what it does is it'll capture the rider's energy while you're braking. It has a removable and rechargeable battery pack. And then when you need it, it'll give you a push. It's as simple as that. Over time, the wheel learns how you pedal, and it basically integrates yourself with the rider's motion. So it's a very natural experience. Suddenly, you just feel like you're, you know, that much stronger than you were before, or that a hill suddenly, you know, doesn't feel like a hill. It feels like flat ground. And then, you know, further with the smartphone, there's a bunch of different apps that you'll be able to customize your ride. You'll be able to track the physical activity, collect different information from the environment around you, and then be able to share it with friends and fellow cyclists. We're also offering an open API for developers who want to create software for the wheel themselves and the community.
And I do want to talk a little bit about the whole community thing. I watched several videos, including, and I can't remember her name, but a presentation that she made about getting the environment around you involved. And I thought that was an interesting concept. So I want to go back to the wheel integrating with your mobile device. Is it going to be Android as well as Apple, or Apple as well as Android?
Yes, we're going to support both.
Okay. And so what exactly is being communicated back from the wheel? I don't understand exactly how it is both storing energy and then learning what you're doing.
Sure. So the smartphone itself, what gets communicated to the wheel is basically different ride modes. So if you want a turbo mode, you know, you want to feel like you're, an Olympic bike racer versus, say, more of an economy mode where maybe it's a little bit less of an assist than what we'll offer in a turbo mode, as well as modes that are things like flatten my city. So it detects slopes, and the bike now knows, okay, I just want an assist when there's hills because I'm fine riding on flat ground. I just don't like riding up hills. And then we're also going to offer the ability to kind of further customize how the wheel actually responds, so how quickly it responds, how intense it responds. You'll be able to customize that within the app.
Wow. That's a lot of stuff going on.
You know, basically, you know, the wheel itself is monitoring, you know, you as you pedal, so it understands how quickly you're pedaling. It understands how much effort you're putting into pedaling, and then the control system that we've spent a lot of time developing is really designed to have a natural feel. So, you know, it's a very smooth transition where all of a sudden, you know, you get this boost of energy.
When I looked at the bike that is set up, that white bike with the wheel, with the red hub, it seems to be using a rear-facing dropout. And you said it'll work on pretty much any bike. Is it a quick release system or is it a bolt-on system?
So it's a bolt-on system, but it'll work with any dropout orientation.
Okay.
Okay. And we're also offering it in basically two different versions to support 120 millimeter dropouts for your single speeds as well as 135 for your multi-speed.
Can you take the 135 and knock it down to 130 for most road? So you're just spacing it out?
Sure. So what we're doing right now is we're actually looking to optimize a couple components, and our plan is to actually get it down to 130.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Most road bikes have a 130 millimeter dropout.
Right. When I think of 135, I think of mountain bike.
Right, right.
So I have a question that everybody's going to ask, and I didn't see it anywhere. What is the wheel weigh? You know, everybody's going to ask that question.
That's right. So the wheel weighs 13 pounds.
Interesting. So 13 pounds. That's not too bad. Are you going to be making it in both 700C and 26 inch?
Yep. So initially, we're going to offer it in both of those wheel sizes.
Okay.
We're also going to offer it in probably a couple different widths for the 700C wheel. So, you know, everything from your skinny road bike tires to your kind of larger 29-inch tires that we're seeing today.
Let's talk a second about repairing the wheel. All right, so, you know, everybody smacks into something, not enough air in the tires, whatever. Is it a standard spoke and rim system?
So the rims are standard.
Okay.
The spokes are custom because of the what we call the smiley-shaped pattern that you see, the way the spoke integrates with the wheel. But
okay,
we're going to sell spokes through our accessory portal, which we'll be releasing in the next couple of months.
Well, that makes perfect sense. I'm speaking with Eric Barber. He is the engineering manager for the Copenhagen Wheel. For all you listeners who have been waiting to know about this, here it is. So let's talk a little bit about the battery charge. How long will a battery charge work? Because I sort of had the sense that it is sort of re-energizing itself as we go, too. Did
so
I understand that?
Right. It will re-energize itself. You know, there is some what we call dynamic braking through the pedals where we basically simulate a coaster brake. So as you're riding along, if you backpedal slightly, there's an electronic coaster brake that'll kick in, and that'll recapture some of your energy during braking, as well as depending on the ride mode that you're in. If you're going down a hill, you'll be able to capture some of that energy as well. But the battery is also chargeable. It takes, 3 to 4 hours to fully charge the battery. And then depending on the mode that you're using the wheel in, it'll give you about 31 miles of range.
It's being designed for urban use. So I want to go to the store. I want to go to work. I want to come back, that kind of stuff. You're not asking people to take this on a century ride.
Right, right, right.
I get it. I want to talk a little bit about this data that can be shared with other people and with the city. What is it that you're envisioning with this data? What kind of data is it capturing other than how fast you're going, how far you're going, you know, how much energy you're using?
Sure. So basically, you know, we're capturing all your basic biking parameters. And what we're also doing is we're opening up basically a section of our hardware where developers are going to be able to integrate custom sensors right into the wheel. So there's a lot of interest for people in different parts of the world to maybe integrate a CO sensor and have a bunch of people ride around with it and collect data, or a CO2 sensor or temperature sensing. So we'll have the ability for people to add that to the wheel and be able to get that information through the Bluetooth link that connects to the phone.
Interesting. And so then you're going to be able to share that with other riders. I sort of got that, but other riders are going to know what your data is. You know, when I think of that, I think of Strava, where you go up and you see what other people are doing. But this sounds a little different from that.
Right. So it's a combination. You know, there's the ability for the developers who want to add more advanced sensors. And then as a normal user, there's the ability to log into a user portal and be able to see, you know, here's the last few rides that you did. Here's where you went, you know, here's how quickly it was. You'll be able to, you know, share that with a friend. Maybe there's a route that you really like, you know, because, you know, there's better bike paths or things like that. So there'll be a kind of a, you know, social network to be able to share that with other riders.
Wow. How weatherproof is this?
So it's, you know, it's designed to work in all environments. So, you know, especially being in Boston and yep. Lately with all the snow we've had, you know, we've been doing demo days every Friday. You know, as long as the road conditions are safe for riders,
sure.
We've been out there. So, you know, it's designed to handle the elements.
I know that the project was originally designed to be used, like, in Copenhagen, hence the name. Are there other countries now looking at it? I know the U.S. is very interested. It's an MIT research. There's that Sensible City Lab at MIT that really was working on it. What are
right.
other countries thinking?
So, you know, right now, we've been offering the wheel for pre-order, basically direct to consumer.
Right.
And, you know, there's been a lot of interest in the U.S., you know, as far as where we're seeing people that are actually purchasing the wheel for pre-order. I think one of the kind of the barriers to entry, so to speak, for e-bikes, from my own personal perspective, is, you know, the price point. A lot of the e-bikes that you see over in Europe, they're pretty expensive bicycles. You know, you can spend easily upwards of 2,000-3,000 euros on some of the different e-bikes that are out there, where, you know, our product kind of approaches it from a different angle where, you know, we've created this wheel that allows you to take this bike that you already love and now add, you know, a new great feature to it.
Interesting. Interesting, because I don't think of a $2,000 or $3,000 bike as expensive, but certainly at the urban level, I probably do.
Right.
You know,
right.
That,
yeah. I mean, your cyclist who's a road cyclist, you know, sure, that's not considered expensive. from a bike standpoint. But I think for, you know, the average user that, you know, you look around the city and you see what kind of bikes people are riding. You
sure.
know, they're older bicycles or they're inexpensive frames.
Well, and then there's the whole, is it going to get ripped off? You know, that's always going to be a fear when you have something so unusual. I mean, if it becomes one of these, everybody's got one, then it's not going to be as scary. But, you know, I'm not sure I would want to leave my Copenhagen wheel bike sitting in a bike rack out front of the coffee shop. What about maintenance? Is this going to be something that the consumer can actually take apart and do something? Or are you going to be training bike shop people? How is that going to work?
So as far as regular maintenance, you know, there should be no more maintenance than what you have with a standard wheel.
Okay.
As far as, you know, the occasional truing that happens to everybody, depending on, you know, how they've been riding, the terrain they've been riding on. And then we're looking at how exactly we're going to develop our service model long term. But, you know, in the short term, you know, we're certainly going to be available to assist people and to be able to handle, you know, bigger issues. One of the nice things, though, that helps us quite a bit is because of the communication with the smartphone, there's a diagnostics capability that we have inherent with that. So we're able to help people know, you know, are they having a problem with their battery pack? Is it a problem with one of the sensors with the electronics or things like that? So we're able to kind of diagnose things remotely and then work with customers to you know, get them, be it a replacement battery or something like that.
Yeah, that was my next question about diagnostics. So, you know, all of the DI2 stuff has computerized diagnostics and you can just plug it in. So that makes perfect sense to me. Well, I only have a couple more questions. One is, are you on track for delivery in mid-May, I think it said?
We're actually going to be releasing a newsletter to everybody who's bought a wheel so far, probably later next week with an update. You know, we're pretty much on track. There's a couple things that we're doing, I think, that's going to be a surprise for people, which is going to be some, you know, features and things that we haven't already come out and talked about that the team's really excited about. As we've been kind of growing the team the past couple of months and brought on some really great people, we've definitely brought some more ideas and some other things that we've looked at improving. So I think we're, you know, we're definitely on track to have something great this summer for everybody.
That's pretty cool. So my last question is sort of an existential one in a way. How do you think our environment might be changed by the kind of work you're doing with a wheel like this and just with the whole concept of urban cycling, and especially in the U.S.? I mean, obviously, Europe is more set up for cycling, Holland sure. especially, and Denmark. But how do you think things are going to change as more things like this come online?
You know, I think one of the biggest things, and what I hear a lot from different people and have even experienced personally, is, you know, there's a lot of people who live within, you know, what you would say is an acceptable distance to commute in. You know, most people don't want to ride for more than a half hour, 45 minutes before work. And the biggest thing is they don't want to get sweaty. They don't want to have to change or shower, you know, once they get to their workplace. And a lot of times that comes down to, oh, I'd love to ride in, but there's this big hill between, you know, my neighborhood and where everything gets flat and easy. So that's why, you know, I do it maybe once a month. So I think having the Copenhagen wheel and being able to take that hill out of the equation, so now riding's an enjoyable experience, I think that's really, you know, what could be a game changer for a lot of people that are in that type of situation where, you know, they live, you know, sub 10 miles, you know, from the office and now have a way to be able to bike.
I think it's a really interesting project. Are you going to be doing demos other than in Cambridge, in your area, in Boston area?
We are. You know, we're definitely looking at doing them in, you know, different parts of the U.S. and potentially some locations in Europe. I don't have the details on that yet, but I'm sure we'll have, you know, more information coming out as we get into the spring and summer here.
Eric, I appreciate you taking time to talk with me about it. I think it's a fascinating project. It certainly is futuristic that sort of is now, and I kind of like that, you know, that whole idea of we thought this could come someday, and someday turned out to be now. I like that.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks for having me.
Oh, you are welcome, and have a wonderful evening, and we'll talk again.
All right. Great.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, that's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed my interview with Steve Frothingham from Bicycle Retailer and Industry News and my encore presentations with Don Ferris and Eric Barber. We will, as I promised, be back next week with a brand new show. Thank you so much for listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.